It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. So one day, a couple of blocks from her home in New Orleans, an artist named Candy Chang noticed an old, boarded-up building that, like a lot of the buildings in New Orleans, had seen better days.
The city has some of the most beautiful architecture in the world, but it also has one of the highest amounts of abandoned properties in America.
This is from Candy Chang's TED Talk. And as an artist, Candy mainly mounts these huge interactive public art projects. Anyway, on that day, when she noticed that particular building near her house, something about it struck her.
I thought about how I could make it a nicer space for my neighborhood. And I also thought about something that changed my life forever. In 2009, I lost someone I loved very much. Her name was Joan, and she was a mother to me. And her death was sudden and unexpected. And I thought about death a lot. And this made me feel deep gratitude for the time I've had and brought clarity to the things that are meaningful to my life now. But I struggle to maintain this perspective in my daily life. I feel like it's easy to get caught up in the day-to-day and forget what really matters to you.
So that was Candy's state of mind that day, walking around her neighborhood, looking at blighted buildings. And she started to think about how, during times of grief, we could maybe find some comfort by sharing that grief. So she came up with an idea. Actually, it was an art project to help her cope. And after she asked permission from the town and from her neighbors, and got a couple of friends together.
I painted the side of this crumbling house with chalkboard paint, and then I stenciled this wall, I think 80 times, with this homemade stencil I made that said, "Before I die, I want to..."
And then, a blank space. Now just imagine you turn a corner in your neighborhood, and you see that written on a giant building-sized chalkboard wall, and next to it, a bucket of chalk, practically inviting you to respond.
"Before I die, I want to..."
Did you, once you put it up, did you, like, just sit there and, like, watch it to see what people would do? Or, like, did you see the first person who wrote something on it?
Yes, I did, because while we were still putting it up, while I was still stenciling the wall, people were walking by asking questions, you know, "What is this?" And a lot of people asked if they could write on it, and we said, "Yes, please do. That's what it's for." So yeah, I saw a lot of people write on it. One of the first people was this man dressed up as a pirate, as you see in New Orleans, who wrote, "Before I die, I want to be tried for piracy."
I didn't know what to expect from this experiment, but by the next day, the wall was entirely filled out, and it kept growing. And I'd like to share a few things that people wrote on this wall. "Before I die, I want to straddle the international dateline. Before I die, I want to sing for millions. Before I die, I want to plant a tree. Before I die, I want to hold her one more time. Before I die, I want to be completely myself."
The power of the "Before I Die" wall was that it actually didn't make people think about death so much as it made them think about life.
I never had any plans to make any walls beyond New Orleans. And I made this wall, posted a few photos online, and then it just spread like wildfire. And my inbox blew up with messages from people around the world who wanted to make a wall with their community.
And within a short period of time,
a thought-provoking public art project is giving people a sense of what it means to live life to the fullest.
More than 1,000 of these walls were mounted in cities all over the world.
The wall here in Patterson has three sides.
All right, folks driving down Broad Street in Elyria might notice a new addition, a giant chalkboard wall.
What do you want to do before you die? Well, you can now publicly answer that question in downtown San Antonio.
How did this project change the way you think about death?
I think that contemplating it can lead to a lot of great things.
I wrote, "I would like to have a relationship with my granddaughter."
"Be a great dad."
"Sail around the world."
If you bring it up, people often say, don't go there, or it's too sad, or you don't need to think about it until you're older. Well, none of us know how much time we have left.
I just wrote that I want to touch all the continents and everything in between.
Go skydiving.
And it's easy to postpone our deepest needs. It's easy to take the people we love for granted. And it's far too easy to neglect our relationship with ourselves.
I probably want to go to Amsterdam. A lot of kids don't know it's a world outside of Patterson. And I just want to, you know, visit that world.
You know, death itself isn't negative.
Explore another culture.
Death just is.
Fulfill my purpose.
And death is going to happen to all of us.
I like to see the world become a better place.
But I think we all carry around a lot of anxieties, and there's great power in knowing you're not alone. You're not alone as you're trying to make sense of your life.
Before I die, I would like to see the community merge with the police.
Become a National Geographic photojournalist.
I wrote that I will never die. I have Jesus.
Change someone's life.
Meet Beyonce.
I want to make a difference in someone else's life.
Before I die, I want to help people remember that they are special and inherently worthy.
I just would like to see my granddaughter. That's my wish before I die.
Death is inescapable. It's what we all face the moment we're born. And yet, it's one of the very few human experiences we don't like talking about. Because death is also about grief and guilt and regret and loss. And we're not going to change those things, but on the show today, we're going to try to take a different look at the narrative around death and why thinking about your own death might even be cathartic.
Contemplating death really clarifies my life, and regularly contemplating death, as the Stoics and other philosophers have encouraged, has been a really powerful tool for me to restore perspective and remember the things that make my life meaningful to me.
So before I die, I want to, how would you finish a sentence?
It's always changing. You know, I'm constantly updating my own responses, which is good because we are always growing and changing. One thing that I want to do is before I die, I want to write a bedtime story. What do you want to do before you die?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, lots of things. I want to babysit my grandkids. I want them, who my children are 4 and 6. So I want to, I want to hang out with them. I want to go somewhere with my grandkids. That's what I want to do before I die.
And that's good to remember. A lot of our time is devoted to seeking the right job or marriage or reputation or outward success. But like many people, I want to be more present with the people I love in my life. And I think that's easy for us to forget.
Artist Candy Chang. You can see her TED Talk at TED.com. And you can find out how to make your own wall by visiting beforeidie.cc. So for most of us, if we're relatively healthy, death seems like a distant thing. It's abstract. And that distance from death is part of what makes it so difficult to talk about.
I mean, you think about people going on to a new job or moving to a different part of the world. You're scared about that.
Yeah.
And you know what that's all about. You actually can vision and picture it. You can't picture what death is all about.
This is journalist Amanda Bennett.
We kind of push away death, and we've got a pretty much arm's length relationship with it.
The story of Amanda's relationship to death and her idea for changing the way we ought to think about it actually starts with her late husband, Terrence. They'd been married for about 20 years when he passed away back in 2007. But before we get there, a little bit about their life before. And on the TED stage, Amanda described the moment they met. She was on a reporting assignment in China, and one night, she went to a party.
I sat down next to a stout middle-aged man with owl glasses and a bow tie. And he turned out to be a Fulbright scholar there in China, specifically to study Sino-Soviet relations. What a gift it was to the eager young foreign correspondent that I was then. I pump him for information. I'm mentally scribbling notes for the stories I plan to write. Talk to him for hours. Only Months later, I discover who he really was. He was the China representative for the American Soybean Association. I don't understand. Soybeans? You told me you were a Fulbright scholar. Well, how long would you have talked to me if I told you you were in soybeans? I said, you jerk. Only jerk wasn't the word I used. I said, you could have gotten me fired. And he said, let's get married. Travel the world and have lots of kids. So we did.
And for a long time, things were great. Amanda and Terrence both had fulfilling careers. They had a son and then a daughter. And then about 13 years into their marriage, everything changed. One morning, Amanda was making breakfast. Their son was having a sleepover. And amidst the chaos of a bunch of boys running around the house, Amanda realized that Terrence was missing.
I finally found him. He was in the bed lying down. He was sort of doubled over in pain. And so we took him to the emergency room, and they were trying to figure out what was wrong with his intestines, his stomach. They realized it was kind of an acute colitis-type thing, a disease of the intestines. But in the course of doing that, they did some scans, and they came back to us and said, you know, after this is over, there's a kind of a shadow on his kidney. You might want to have it looked at. The shadow in his kidney turned out to be kidney cancer.
It was a rare and aggressive type of kidney cancer.
I looked it up, and there probably had been 50 cases documented in the world, and every one of them had died within a year. So that's our first end-of-life warning, is like, you're going to die in a year.
What did you do next?
This is the part that always seems both so incredibly human and natural and also deluded. I thought, I'm smart, I'm strong, I'm a journalist, I can find out things. I'm going to find out what it takes to keep him alive forever.
Coming up, what Amanda Bennett learned about life as she grappled with the possibility of Terrence's death. Today on the show, Rethinking the Narrative Around Death. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. And on the show today, ideas about the narrative around death, how we might start to change the way we think about it. And we're just hearing from journalist Amanda Bennett. When her husband, Terrence, was diagnosed with a rare form of kidney cancer, they made a decision. They were not going to let his disease interfere with their lives. Amanda says they weren't denying reality. They simply had hope. So shortly after his diagnosis, Terrence learned Arabic. He started a new job. He threw himself back into his life.
And for years, it seemed like we were succeeding. The surgeon emerged from the surgery. What did he say? He said what surgeons always say, we got it all. Then there was a setback when the pathologists looked at the kidney cancer closely, and yet he did not die. Mysteriously, he lived on. He coached Little League for our son. He built a playhouse for our daughter. And meanwhile, I'm burying myself in the internet looking for specialists. I'm looking for a cure. So a year goes by before the cancer, as cancers do, reappears. And with it comes another death sentence, this time 9 months. So we try another treatment. Aggressive, nasty. It makes him so sick he has to quit it, yet still he lives on. Then another year goes by. 2 years go by. More specialists. We take the kids to Italy. We take the kids to Australia. And then more years pass, and the cancer begins to grow. This time there's new treatments on the horizon. They're exotic. They're experimental. They're going to attack the cancer in new ways. So he enters a clinical trial, and it works. The cancer begins to shrink, and for the third time, we've dodged death.
It went on like this for 7 years. Terrence would get sick, he'd get better again, until one night when his health finally took a turn for the worse.
A 20-something resident that I've never met before tells me that Terrence is dying. Perhaps tonight. So what do I say when he says, what do you want me to do? There's another drug out there. It's newer. It's more powerful. He started it just 2 weeks ago. Perhaps there's still hope ahead. So what do I say? I say, keep him alive if you can. And Terrence died 6 days later. So we fought, we struggled, we triumphed. It was an exhilarating fight. And I'd repeat the fight today without a moment's hesitation. We fought together, we lived together. It turned what could have been 7 of the grimmest years of our life into 7 of the most glorious. We pushed the fight right over the edge, and I never got the chance to say to him, hey, buddy, it was a hell of a ride. We never got the chance to say goodbye. We never thought it was the end. We always had hope. So, what the experts call denial, I call hope. And I'd like to borrow a phrase from my friends in software design. You just redefine denial at hope, and it becomes a feature of being human. It's not a bug, it's a feature.
Was that hope that you guys had, did it help you through it?
Oh, I think it was critical because, as it turned out, there really wasn't a lot of effective treatment against kidney cancer. So really what happened to him just sort of happened. I mean, we may have helped extend his life a little, but not much with what we did. What was really important was, what was that 7 years going to be like? Were we going to live that 7 years in fear and looking around the corner for every second? And, you know, as I look back on those 7 years, those are some of the 7 best years of our lives. We were alive. We were excited. We traveled. Our kids grew up. Those were good 7 years. And I think that hope and, you know, what people would call denial, it protected those 7 years for us. And I think that's worth a lot.
I mean, it's amazing that you guys carried on, I mean, knowing that at some point he'd be gone.
I mean, this is one of the reasons why I so hate the word denial, because people talk about, doctors in particular, hospitals, and even other people, talk about denial as if it's some failing.
Yeah.
And that all you really need to do is get over that failing, this delusional thinking. But think about the things that brought to us. Denial is also hope, and hope is what we all live on.
After his death, how long did it take you to kind of begin to see it as, or sort of reframe that experience, to sort of see it as is what it was, this incredible period of your life?
I think it was almost right away. You know, obviously, like with most people, it was extremely, extremely hard. But I felt at the end like we had both given it our best shot. And I think that the, you know, so-called, quote, denial helped me, because I wound up more than feeling sad that I lost him, I felt grateful that we had had such a good time together.
During Terrence's illness, giving up the fight, for that's how it felt like giving up, meant giving up not only his life, but also our story. Our story of us as fighters. The story of us as invincible. And for the doctors, the story of themselves as healers. So what do we need? Maybe we need a new story. We have a noble path to curing the disease, patients and doctors alike. But there doesn't seem to be a noble path to dying. Dying is seen as failing. And we had a heroic narrative for fighting together, but we didn't have a heroic narrative for letting go. So maybe we need a narrative for acknowledging the end and for saying goodbye. And maybe our new story will be about a hero's fight and a hero's goodbye.
This idea of a heroic narrative for death, how do we create that?
You know, the narrative that's out there is that you're fighting a disease, you're fighting cancer, you're beating something. And so there's the sense that you're this heroic person for fighting it off, but you're not heroic for losing. So that's where I feel like I could have gotten lost if I had felt that we had lost something. I think that we ran 100 miles an hour until we hit the end, and I think that's a heroic journey. I think we've got to have some conversation that says, I've done everything well in my life. I'm now going to do this well, too.
Has it changed the way you think about your own death? Do you think that you probably fear it less than most people would?
No, I don't think so. I still think I've got the normal share of it. And as I say, it's a complicated feeling. And it's not so much that you're afraid of what comes next, but you're afraid of what you're going to leave behind.
Yeah. It's interesting because hearing your story, it seems like his experience taught you as much about living as it did about dying.
Well, no kidding. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, just one natural human thing in the way I lived my life was I was more focused in our lives with fixing what was bad. When in fact, it just completely flipped over to saying, you know what? That's not as important. There's this whole other side of it that's just wonderful and extraordinary. And I can live in that spot more. Instead of living in the shadow and trying to make the shadow better, I can live in the light and really expand that piece of it. And I really think I've stayed with that.
Amanda Bennett, she wrote a book about her experience. It's called The Cost of Hope. You can see her entire TED Talk at TED.com.
Would you say that you have an interest in death?
I'm obsessed with death. And
this is artist J. Rim Lee.
I go by J. Rim or J.R. I also go by J. Grim or J. Reaper. I have a bunch of nicknames.
J. Rim's art focuses a lot on the human body. She's created wearable furniture and sculptures of bodies at rest. But she's always wondered about what we do with our bodies after we die. So a few years ago, J. Rim started an art project inspired by that thought, a thought she'd had since she was a kid.
Someone very close to me experienced a loss and was in sort of an extended period of grief. And I grew up witnessing that and really learning as a child that, you know, death is an end. And that when someone close to you dies, it's sort of the end of your life in many ways. And so the project really was inspired by this kind of deeper need to find a new kind of way of thinking about death, to think about death as a moment of transformation. And I'm not a religious person, so I needed something that was based in sort of things that didn't require faith. So for me, that meant returning to the earth.
And when J. Rim says returning to the earth, she means our bodies after we die. And not in a casket, not cremated, but buried into the ground to decompose and eventually create new life. But as she explained on the TED stage, there's just one problem. Our bodies are full of toxic stuff.
The Centers for Disease Control in the U.S. says we have 219 toxic pollutants in our bodies. And this includes preservatives, pesticides, and heavy metals like lead and mercury. So what happens to all these toxins when we die? The short answer is they return to the environment in one way or another, continuing the cycle of toxicity. But our current funeral practices make the situation much worse. If you're cremated, all those toxins I mentioned are released into the atmosphere, and this includes 5,000 pounds of mercury, from our dental fillings alone every year. And in a traditional American funeral, a dead body is covered with fillers and cosmetics to make it look alive. It's then pumped with toxic formaldehyde to slow decomposition, a practice which causes respiratory problems and cancer in funeral personnel. So by trying to preserve our dead bodies, we deny death, poison the living, and further harm the environment.
Okay, so if, as you say, cremation is bad, if burial is bad, what's left?
I mean, one of the thoughts that I had was how can we, you know, a lot of green products purport to do less harm, right? You're using less fossil fuels. You're using less energy. You're using less resources. But I felt that we could take a step further, that not only could our burial and our death be less harmful, but actually beneficial to the earth, where we can use our bodies and we can return all the nutrients in our bodies to the earth and have that be a moment of transformation and renewal.
So when you die, like how do you want to be buried?
I'd like to be buried with mushrooms.
Mushrooms? She said mushrooms. Can you explain that a little bit, J-Rim?
Yeah, so mushrooms emit enzymes that break down organic material. Gourmet mushrooms like oyster mushrooms and shiitake mushrooms and shaggy manes and hen of the woods.
Yum.
Turns out that they are really amazing toxin remediators. So they clean the toxins in the soil. They are the master decomposers. They're one of the first species to come in and help decompose organic material in the forest.
So when you look at mushrooms, you're not thinking dinner, you're thinking death?
I think both. I normally don't think about death when I'm, you know, faced with some mushrooms in the grocery store. I'm thinking about how I'm going to saute them with butter and olive oil. Mm. And maybe a little soy sauce.
A little bit of wine, some chives.
Exactly.
I mean, normally, I think most of us think about them that way, but it turns out they actually are pretty useful for death.
Absolutely.
Mushrooms, specific types of mushrooms, like shiitakes and oysters, J-Rim actually calls them infinity mushrooms, they can decompose human bodies pretty quickly.
All right, so for some of you, this may be really, really out there. Just a little. I realize this is not the kind of relationship we usually aspire to have with our food. We want to eat, not be eaten by our food, right? I imagine the infinity mushroom as a symbol of a new way of thinking about death and the relationship between my body and the environment. See, for me, cultivating the infinity mushroom is more than just scientific experimentation or gardening or raising a pet. It's a step towards accepting the fact that someday, I will die and decay. It's also a step towards taking responsibility for my own burden on the planet.
Growing the mushroom. Okay, so this might be a good place to explain that J-Rim isn't suggesting we just like throw a bunch of mushrooms on top of a dead body. She's actually suggesting something a little different, because for her appearance on the TED stage, J-Rim wore a special outfit. She was dressed from head to toe in a black shroud with white netting sewn on top, which she calls her ninja pajamas. But the outfit was actually a burial suit.
A burial suit infused with mushroom spores. The mushroom death suit. I'm wearing the second prototype of this burial suit. It's covered with a crocheted netting that is embedded with mushroom spores. I'm also making a cocktail of capsules that contain infinity mushroom spores and other elements that speed decomposition and toxin remediation. These capsules are embedded in a nutrient-rich jelly, a kind of second skin, which dissolves quickly and becomes baby food for the growing mushrooms.
Okay, so let me see if I understand this. The suit basically turns our bodies into mulch, right? Like it turns us into this really nutrient-rich soil?
Absolutely. That's the intention of it. And not only does that, it helps deliver nutrients to plant roots so that they grow better.
So this might be a kind of like a dumb question, but what if it works so well that like trees and plants start like growing out of the grave and then you just like you can't see it anymore?
That actually would be beautiful.
So this idea, it's not just an out there art project anymore. It's actually become a real thing. And since giving this talk back in 2011, J-Rim got so many requests for her mushroom burial suit that she decided to start a company to sell them. And today, just like a casket or a gravestone, you can buy one for you or for someone you love. But don't you think there might be a resistance from some people who might think like, do I really want the last memory of me to be in like a mushroom suit?
Definitely.
Yeah, right. Like you're walking by the casket and you're like, he's in a mushroom suit.
Right. Well, my hope is that the suit will be this kind of beautiful object, and that the vision of the person in the suit is actually something that's beautiful.
Like angelic, beautiful and sort of glowing.
Possibly. Or beautiful and rock and roll.
So in some ways, it's like maybe this is kind of the beginning of how we can rethink death, you know? Like instead of this end, it's more of a beginning.
It's a beginning, and it's also a moment in our cycle, right? That we come from all the nutrients in the earth, and then we consume the nutrients in the earth, and then we return to the earth, and then re-deliver those nutrients back to the earth. So death is just a moment in that cycle.
Artist J. Rim Lee, you can find out more about the mushroom burial suit at coeo.com. That's coeio.com. And you can watch her full talk at TED.com. More ideas about rethinking the narrative of death in just a minute. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, ideas about changing the narrative around death. And death, for many of us, we don't really know how or when it's going to happen. And in his line of work, TED speaker Matthew O'Reilly meets people all the time who suddenly, without warning, find themselves facing it. And in his short talk, he described the surprising thing so many of these people have in common.
I've been a critical care EMT for the past 7 years in Suffolk County, New York. I've been a first responder in a number of incidents ranging from car accidents to Hurricane Sandy. If you're like most people, death might be one of your greatest fears. Some of us will see it coming. Some of us won't. Throughout my career, I've responded to a number of incidents where a patient had minutes left to live, and there was nothing I could do for them. With this, I was faced with a dilemma. Do I tell the dying that they are about to face death, or do I lie to them to comfort them? Early in my career, I faced this dilemma by simply lying. That all changed with one incident. 5 years ago, I responded to a motorcycle accident. The rider had suffered critical injuries. As I assessed him, I realized that there was nothing that could be done for him. And like so many other cases, he looked me in the eye and asked that question, am I going to die? In that moment, I decided to do something different. I decided to tell him the truth. His reaction shocked me to this day. He simply laid back and had a look of acceptance on his face. He was not met with that terror or fear that I thought he would be. He simply laid there, and as I looked into his eyes, I saw inner peace and acceptance. From that moment forward, I decided it was not my place to comfort the dying with my lies. Having responded to many cases since then where patients were in their last moments and there was nothing I could do for them, in almost every case, they have all had the same reaction to the truth of inner peace and acceptance. In fact, there are three patterns I have observed in all these cases. The first pattern: regardless of religious belief or cultural background, there's a need for forgiveness. Whether they call it sin or they simply say they have a regret, their guilt is universal. I had once cared for an elderly gentleman who was having a massive heart attack. He already knew by my tone of voice and body language. As I placed the defibrillator pads on his chest, prepping for what was going to happen, He looked me in the eye and said, I wish I had spent more time with my children and grandchildren instead of being selfish with my time. Faced with imminent death, all he wanted was forgiveness. The second pattern I observed is the need for remembrance. There's a need for immortality within the hearts and thoughts of their loved ones, myself, my crew, or anyone around. Countless times, I have had a patient look me in the eyes and say, will you remember me? The final pattern I observed always touched me the deepest. The dying need to know that their life had meaning. This came to me very, very early in my career. I'd responded to a call. There was a female in her late 50s pinned within a vehicle. Critical condition. As the fire department worked to remove her from the car, I climbed in to begin to render care. As we talked, she had said to me, there was so much more I wanted to do with my life. It would turn out that she was a mother of two adopted children who were both on their way to medical school. Because of her, two children had a chance they never would have had otherwise and would go on to save lives in the medical field as medical doctors. It would end up taking 45 minutes to free her from the vehicle. However, she perished prior to freeing her. I believed what you saw in the movies. You're in those last moments that is strictly terror, fear. I've come to realize, regardless of the circumstance, it's generally met with peace and acceptance. Thank you.
Matthew O'Reilly is an emergency medical technician on Long Island in New York. You can see his entire talk at TED.com. Do you fear death?
You know, sitting here, I'd say no, I don't really fear death. A bigger fear, I would say, is that I not take full advantage of the time that I have.
This is Dr. B.J. Miller.
I am a palliative care physician. I practice at UCSF, but my main job is as executive director of the Zen Hospice Project here in San Francisco.
When I hear that word, hospice, I'd be lying to you if I didn't say I get a flutter. It's where you go to die. I mean, that's it.
You know, I think you're right. These are loaded, loaded words. But when you start wrapping your head around mortality and the fact that we are finite, you know, that we die, among other things, you kind of realize, well, this life I have is an amazing phenomenon. I should take it seriously. Or my gosh, everyone I know, everyone I've even hated dies. Maybe this could be a force of unity and connection. So it's complicated, and I don't mean to talk you out of being a little bit frightened by the word hospice. That's very real. But there is a field, there are people waiting, trained to accompany you once you walk through those doors.
PJ thinks that we could apply the hospice philosophy to elements of our medical system, especially our hospitals. Here's BJ on the TED stage.
Now, the American healthcare system has more than its fair share of dysfunction. And believe me, most everyone who goes into healthcare really means well. But healthcare was designed with diseases, not people, at its center. And nowhere are the effects of bad design more heartbreaking or the opportunity for good design more compelling than at the end of life, where things are so distilled and concentrated. My purpose today is to reach out and invite design thinking into this big conversation. We have a monumental opportunity in front of us to rethink and redesign how it is we die.
PJ's ideas about how we design for death and dying, as you might expect, come from his experiences as a doctor and from working with his hospice patients. But those ideas also come from his own life and something he went through.
Having come close to death myself, sure, that was formative.
Can you tell me what happened?
Yeah, so I was 19, sophomore year of college. Very fortunate to be at Princeton University. My friends and I, we had just gotten back from Thanksgiving break. It was a Monday night. I remember I had to go print off a paper I was writing, and we decided to go hang out and, you know, just chill out for a little while, walk around, cruise around. It wasn't a crazy night. And there's a commuter train that used to run right onto campus. And, you know, just sitting there, and it wasn't running. It wasn't an active train. It was just sitting there. And we decided to climb it like you would, like a jungle gym or a tree. We'd done some dumb things, believe me. But this, we didn't think was actually that dumb. So we just kind of scurried up. I just happened to be the first one up. And I had a metal watch on. And when I stood up, the power lines run overhead of the New Jersey Transit lines. The electricity arced to the metal watch, entered my arm, and blew down and out my feet. And that was that.
What's the next thing you remember? I mean, waking up?
Well, you know that feeling when you wake up from a dream and it was a bad dream? Well, I woke up in this burn unit and looked around and somehow still managed to have the sensation that the whole thing was a dream. Then I have this sensation I have to go to the bathroom. So I think I'll get out of bed, right? So I pull out the central lines in my jugular veins in my neck. I extubate myself because I'm on a ventilator, a breathing machine. And I swung my legs out of bed and just started walking to the door, shuffling to the door to go to the bathroom. And then the Foley line, it's a catheter that goes into your, sits in your bladder. But as I'm walking towards the door and reach for the door, the catheter ran out of line and it jerked on the tubing and the moment reversed. All of it, realizing this all whole thing was not a dream, came crashing back. From there, I remember most of the experience.
BJ nearly died from the electricity that coursed through his body. He lost both of his legs below the knees and his left arm below the elbow. And everything about his life from that point forward changed.
I spent a few months in a burn unit at St. Barnabas Hospital in Livingston, New Jersey, where I got really great care at every turn, including good palliative care for my pain. And one night, it began to snow outside, and there was no window in my room, but it was great to just imagine it coming down all sticky. Next day, one of my nurses smuggled in a snowball for me. I cannot tell you the rapture I felt holding that in my hand. The coldness dripping onto my burning skin, the fascination as I watched it melt and turn into water. In that moment, that little snowball packed all the inspiration I needed to both try to live and be okay if I did not.
During his long recovery period, BJ began to ask himself basic questions about his identity and his purpose. He decided to finish his degree and then to use his experience as a now disabled person to help others. He eventually went to med school, but during his residency, BJ began to realize how the system was failing patients.
And the volume of those failings became louder and louder and began to dwarf the suffering of just the suffering that goes along with dying. The sort of man-made elements of it, the created elements of it, were extra tragic. So seeing the system as a source of the pain lifts your gaze to a different way. And that's the arc to get me to palliative care when I got turned on to policy towards thinking about a health system, etc.
Flash forward, now I work at an amazing place in San Francisco called the Zen Hospice Project. When one of our residents dies, the mortuary men come, and as we're wheeling the body out through the garden, heading for the gate, we pause. Anyone who wants to share a story or a song or silence as we sprinkle the body with flower petals to usher in grief with warmth. Contrast that with the typical experience in the hospital setting. Floodlit room lined with tubes and beeping machines and blinking lights that don't stop even when the patient's life has. Cleaning crew swoops in, the body's whisked away. It feels as though that person had never really existed. Well-intended, of course, in the name of sterility, but hospitals tend to assault our senses. I revere hospitals for what they can do. I am alive because of them. But we ask too much of our hospitals. They're no place to live and die. That's not what they were designed for.
You know, if you've been in a hospital, you get the feeling that that place is designed for throughput. So if you look at the physical plant of some of our institutions, they really are designed for to accommodate the clinician before the patient.
Yeah.
So there's a good cue for the design world. You know, why haven't our major architects, why have they not gotten involved in designing hospitals? It seems like an incredible creative enterprise. And beyond that, well, you know, how do we suffer? Well, poor communication, right? So doctors aren't trained in the very tricky art of communicating bad news and supporting people through difficult times. Otherwise, staffing the system around the human experience rather than the disease itself. So we might get really good at, if you have a major test that's going to tell you if you're dying soon or if you've got an open-ended lifespan, you know, you're not left waiting for a week or two to hear the results of that test.
If teasing unnecessary suffering out of the system was our first design cue, then tending to dignity by way of the senses, by way of the body, the aesthetic realm is design cue number two. Probably the most poignant room in a Zen hospice guest house is our kitchen, which is a little strange when you realize that so many of our residents can eat very little, but we realize we are providing sustenance on several levels. Seriously, with all the heavy-duty stuff happening under our roof, one of the most tried-and-true interventions we know of is to bake cookies. As long as we have our senses, even just one, we have at least the possibility of accessing what makes us feel human, connected.
You know, some of this seems so simple, and yet we've been so bad at making the end-of-life experience better. Why? Why is that?
You know, from an existential point of view, right? We're future-oriented beings.
Yeah.
We walk around with a buffer in front of us of a future. We plan for tomorrow, for next week, et cetera. But then when you're out of a future, it can really kind of short-circuit our human minds.
But I mean, we are all dying, right? I mean, the clock is ticking on all of us, like, that's what it means to be human.
Right. And it's part of living. And this is a critical distinction. Death versus dying. You know, dying, you're still living, you know, inherently. Dying people are alive. And this is a major theme of getting beyond the fear, is realizing, oh, dying people are alive. So, all right, so let's pay attention to it. Let's design for it.
So much of what we're talking about today is a shift in perspective. I am asking we make space so that aging and dying can become a process of crescendo through to the end. Now, parts of me died early on, and that's something we can all say one way or another. I got to redesign my life around this fact, and I tell you, it has been a liberation to realize you can always find a shock of beauty or meaning in what life you have left. Like that snowball lasting for a perfect moment, all the while melting away. If we love such moments ferociously, then maybe we can learn to live well, not in spite of death, but because of it. Let death be what takes us, not lack of imagination. Thank you.
E.J. Miller, he runs the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. You can see his talk at TED.com, and you can learn more at zenhospice.org.
I'm gonna live till I die. I'm gonna laugh instead of cry. I'm gonna take the town and turn it upside down. I'm gonna live, live, live until I die.
Hey, thanks for listening to our show about rewriting the narrative around death. Our production staff at NPR includes Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Neva Grant, Megan Kane, Sanaz Meshkinpour, and Casey Herman. With help from Daniel Shukin, our intern is Maria Paz Gutierrez. Our partners at TED include Chris Anderson, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. Today's show is dedicated to the memory of my mother-in-law, Dr. Rosalie Stott, who sadly passed during the production of this episode. Roz, we tried to make this one uplifting. Hope we succeeded. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading right here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.